Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Steve Jobs isn't just the founder and CEO of Apple. He's the company's very public face, and many would argue its heart and soul, which explains why today's announcement that he's taking another medical leave could literally shake this Apple to its very core. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl, who's off in observance of this Martin Luther King Day, the 17th of January. Thanks for making us a part of your Monday. Word that Steve Jobs is taking leave from Apple again to focus on health issues shouldn't really come as a shock to investors. He's battled pancreatic cancer, and he's been through a liver transplant. Jobs sent employees an email today. It said, "I love Apple so much and hope to be back as soon as I can." But his optimistic spin didn't keep Apple stock from falling in overseas trading today by as much as 8%. Still, as Marketplace's David Gurra reports, investors might want to hold that sell order.
A couple of years ago, Steve Jobs looked sick. He was gaunt with owl-like eyes. Those black turtlenecks didn't seem to fit right. In 2009, he took a six-month leave of absence.
And the company actually was just fine while he was gone.
Peter Cohen is a management consultant. Today's announcement raised new speculation about the company's future. It came on a federal holiday when U.S. markets were closed, and just a day before Apple is supposed to announce new earnings numbers. Carl Howe is a technology analyst with the Yankee Group. He says Steve Jobs has done wonders for the company, but he may get too much credit for its success.
Nobody runs a $50 billion-plus company as a one-man show.
Howe says it's a myth Jobs is pulling all the levers at Apple.
No question, he made the hard decisions. He made a lot of the gut calls that really have made them successful. But the reality is there's a lot of people behind him who are doing their jobs every day and making Apple successful.
That group includes the company's chief operating officer, Tim Cook. He'll oversee Apple on a day-to-day basis while Jobs is on leave. Howe also credits Jonathan Ive, its head designer, and Ron Johnson, who heads Apple's retail operations.
9 years ago, everybody said retail was a fool's errand for Apple. Now it's one of the most powerful retail brands in the world. And that's not because Steve Jobs did all the work.
Howe says Steve Jobs has drafted a succession plan, but it's unclear what's in it. And that's somehow fitting for a man who's built a brand on secrecy and surprise. I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
What happens when you engage in offshore banking tricks does not necessarily stay offshore or stay secret. Today, a former Swiss banker gave the website WikiLeaks the names of around 2,000 alleged tax dodgers with accounts in the Cayman Islands. WikiLeaks is reviewing the information and plans to release it in coming weeks. And yes, at least some names to be revealed are said to be Americans. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has been looking into the possible fallout.
Former banker Rudolf Elmer shared the private banking data with WikiLeaks just days before he goes on trial in Switzerland for revealing confidential bank information. But chances are slim that publicizing secret bank accounts in the Cayman Islands will result in prosecutions in this country. For one thing, the Cayman Islands is working to clean up its reputation. Gary Huffbauer is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the Caymans has an agreement with the U.S. Justice Department to
reveal data on suspicious bank accounts. So anybody who wants to hide money, either for tax reasons or for drug-related reasons, would be pretty ill-advised to use the Cayman Islands.
The pending WikiLeaks disclosure is part of an ongoing trend to shine more light on the darkened recesses of international banking. But just because a tax dodger is publicly exposed doesn't mean the IRS will take legal action.
They're doing the best they can, but this takes more resources than they've got.
That's David Rosenblum, an offshore banking expert with the law firm Kaplan and Drysdale. To help the IRS build legal cases, Rosenblum says the agency has added an incentive for whistleblowers.
You can get a reward for turning information in. That sounds to me like a very nice potential retirement plan for employees of foreign banks.
If people no longer trust the Cayman Islands to keep their accounts secret, where is the money moving? Experts say the new tax havens of choice are Singapore and Macau. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
As the nation honors Martin Luther King Jr. with celebrations, forums, and speeches, we're taking a look at one aspect of African-American economic well-being, home ownership. A lot more black families were able to get into starter homes in the last decade as subprime lending helped push African-American home ownership to record highs. But now, foreclosures are rampant, and African-Americans are losing ground fast. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Martin Luther King Jr. grew up in a house in Atlanta that his grandfather bought in 1909 for $3,500. Civil rights groups have long pushed home ownership as a path to greater economic independence. By the mid-2000s, a combination of government affordable lending programs and risky subprime mortgages had boosted the African-American home ownership rate to an all-time high, just under 50%. But since then, it's fallen hard.
There's no question it's been catastrophic.
Mark Morial is president of the National Urban League, and I reached him on his way to an MLK Day forum in New York.
We've lost as much ground in the last 3 to 4 years as we had gained in the previous 20 to 25 years. That's how stark it is for black America.
African American home ownership has fallen more than 3%, twice as much as the population at large, and also more than Hispanics and Asians.
African Americans have been subject to more subprime lending and targeting.
Economist Susan Wachter at the Wharton School says a lot of those loans were inappropriate or fraudulent. Add to that high unemployment among African Americans, and the result is a soaring foreclosure rate. In Ohio, for instance, more than 1 in 10 may ultimately lose their homes. Jerry Mason lives in Euclid, Ohio, and she's seen lots of bank seizures in her neighborhood. She narrowly avoided foreclosure herself by getting a mortgage repayment plan.
I say the best feeling I ever got in my life is pulling into my driveway for that first time. I mean, I still think it's an awesome thing to be able to do to own a home, but the financial meltdown and the mortgage crisis and the credit crisis we've had here in this country, a lot of people aren't going to have that feeling.
Groups like the National Urban League are hoping more African Americans can again walk into homes that they own. They're pushing urban homesteading initiatives to get working families into foreclosed properties that they can renovate. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street took a holiday break, but mostly sell was the order of the day in Europe. Details when we do the numbers. On this Martin Luther King Day, it's appropriate to focus on issues of social justice. And they aren't limited to discrimination and civil rights battles. As we alluded to earlier, the recession has added new struggles to the list. It's led to foreclosures, bankruptcies, and credit problems. And some lawyers who do pro bono work are adding those sorts of cases to their lists. But that brings us to this challenge. What happens when lawyers, too, are vulnerable to shifting economic fortunes? New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein reports.
At the end of 2008, as the housing bubble burst, lawyer Karen McGinley realized lots of homeowners were in trouble, and they couldn't afford someone like her.
You know, I felt that there, but for the grace of God, go I. And if I could help one, two, or more people keep their homes and survive this recession, that it would be very worthwhile.
About 2 years later, McGinley has already donated over 100 hours to several pro bono cases. She spent nearly half that time working with the White family. The family of four lives in a 19th century home in western New Hampshire. The trouble started when the interest rate on Mrs. White's subprime adjustable rate mortgage jumped.
Her mortgage went from $600 to $1,400.
Her daughter, Robin White, says the New Hampshire bar put them in touch with attorney McGinley, who's been trying to get them a new mortgage.
If it were not for her, we wouldn't be in our home right now. We would be on the street and not knowing where we would be living, plain and simple.
McGinley estimates she's given the Whites about $28,000 worth of legal services. But not everyone can afford to be as generous as McGinley.
I think there's no question that the amount of pro bono work that is being done is less.
Lawyer Michael Pratt is with the Philadelphia-based firm Pepper Hamilton. He chairs the American Bar Association's Committee on Pro Bono and Public Service. Pratt says there's no hard data on pro bono hours during the recession, but some firms have let employees who coordinate that work go. Legal advocacy groups that handle civil rights and other cases are having a harder time soliciting help from the private sector, and lots of firms have simply laid lawyers off.
And it just makes sense. If the recession is having an impact on law firms generally, on their revenues, that they're having an impact on the amount of pro bono work that's being done.
Things are a little different in New Hampshire. The bar here has seen a slight increase in pro bono hours over 2009. Attorney Karen McGinley has had a hand in that. She started a group of about 50 lawyers who help homeowners make their way through the mortgage crisis. She says it's been time well spent.
Even if I do a multi-million dollar transaction on, you know, a big commercial piece of property, it's not as personally as important as saving someone's home.
McGinley says it doesn't look like her work is going to end anytime soon. State housing experts predict 2011 will beat 2010 for record numbers of home foreclosures. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
America's Got Talent, and it comes from the UK. You might recognize the new host in Larry King's time slot on CNN tonight. British journalist Piers Morgan will be kicking off his new show. As Jennifer Collins reports, CNN is gambling it'll bring back viewers.
Larry King is an icon. He's been on the air for 25 years, and besides those suspenders, he's known for his softball questions, and recently, his even softer ratings.
Larry King had run his course, let's be frank.
Toby Miller is a professor of popular culture at the University of California, Riverside. He says King was getting creamed by more combative hosts like Sean Hannity on Fox News. CNN had also been losing viewers to MSNBC in King's time slot. Paul DeGarabedian is an entertainment analyst.
Well, I think 9 o'clock on CNN has been thought of as kind of a sleepy time slot, and I think programmers now can think of it as an opportunity.
Morgan is best known here as a judge on America's Got Talent and former winner of Donald Trump's Celebrity Apprentice. He started as a tabloid journalist in the UK, and kid gloves aren't in his wardrobe. Here's what Donald Trump had to say about him.
You're certainly not diplomatic, but you did an amazing job and you beat the hell out of everybody.
Morgan was all charm when Larry King handed him the reins.
It's a great honor to be joining the network and to work with you.
It's easy to replace me. Just
And that's no joke. Toby Miller says Morgan's tabloid background and more confrontational interview style is likely to attract new viewers, especially during his first weeks on the air.
People who want some verbal sparring and even some bitchiness with a British accent will probably get that delivered to them.
Morgan will also have to deliver a steady stream of big-name guests. Tonight, he's got that covered with Oprah. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, thinking about having children?
The total cost, according to the Department of Agriculture, is about $222,000. That does not include any savings for college.
And that's per child, by the way. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., Wall Street had the day off, but markets were in full swing elsewhere. Uncertainty over whether to expand the EU bailout fund left European markets mixed. The German DAX picked up 2 points, a fraction of a percent, but Britain's FTSE dropped 16 points, or nearly 0.3%. The French CAC 40 followed suit, losing 7 points, or 0.2%. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei index added 3 points, just a fraction percentage-wise, and the Shanghai Composite gave back 84 points. That's 3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The International Energy Agency issues its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. And it's 2 days on internet policy. The annual State of the Net conference convenes in Washington. You can follow it on Twitter. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. 50 years ago today, in 1961, just days before John F. Kennedy took over the Oval Office, Dwight D. Eisenhower gave his final speech as president. It would go down as one of the most memorable exit speeches for any president, a speech in which he warned about the growing influence of the military.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
To help us understand what President Eisenhower meant, we turn to James Ledbetter, editor at Reuters.com. His new book is called Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
So what was President Eisenhower getting at when he made those remarks?
Eisenhower, who of course had been a five-star general and had led the Allied forces in World War II, really felt in the final years of his presidency that the military and the Democratic Party were conspiring to increase military expenditures in a way for which there was no military need. There was a lot of fury about a so-called missile gap, that the United States was falling behind in producing missiles. Well, this wasn't true. Eisenhower knew it wasn't true, but he really couldn't divulge the source of his information, which was the U-2 spy plane data, because it was top secret. And so I think the farewell address was really an attempt to warn the nation that without some degree of supervision, there was no part of this military-industrial complex that was going to stop itself.
And he pointed out that this was a new phenomenon in American history, that the U.S. had no armaments industry until fairly recently. And then we stopped drawing down our troops because I guess our perception of the threat was changed during the Cold War. Now, basically, we're being sold on a whole new number of threats. Let me play you a little bit of a promotional video from Northrop Grumman and ask you if this is the kind of thing Eisenhower was envisioning.
Everything we know, the lives we lead, the communities we create, the enterprises we build are at risk every minute of every day. Threats to our health and financial well-being, hackers, rogue states and terrorists.
So, does fear feed the military-industrial complex, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, it is more nuanced, but it's definitely the case that fear fuels it. I love that you focused on advertising because it was, in fact, advertisements for military contractors that irked Eisenhower and his advisors. They would go through these aerospace journals like Aviation Week, and you flip through them and you see all of these ads for missile systems and guidance systems and satellite systems. And the thing that made them crazy was there was only one customer, and that was the Pentagon. But I think you can argue that these ads are designed to sell the rest of us into accepting the sort of political and economic equation that makes these things necessary.
Anti-war activists often cling to Eisenhower's speech as an argument to stay out of conflict and decrease military spending. Is that really what he was suggesting, that we not build up our military?
No. Eisenhower was no pacifist, and he believed in fighting the Cold War and winning it. However, he was very concerned that we would, quote, win the Cold War, unquote, at any cost.
And Eisenhower warned that only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry could change that. Are we alert and knowledgeable today?
We are now spending, depending on how you count the numbers, something like $1 trillion a year on the military, more in constant dollars than was the case at any time since World War II. And it's not clear that the military spending that we do today is the most effective and most efficient. So I think that the same tensions that he identified are still there. And sadly, the solution is the same. It can't be done from the political process in and of itself because there are too many beneficiaries. Congress was a beneficiary. The military was a beneficiary. It has to come from the only thing that exists outside of the military-industrial complex, and that is the minds of the people.
James Ledbetter is editor at Reuters.com. His new book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
You can read a chapter from his book and hear an extended interview that explores the economic challenges in decoupling industry and the military. It's all at marketplace.org/thebigbook. So a while back, we heard about this hospital in Maryland that was holding a financial planning seminar for expectant parents. And we immediately thought our own Nancy Marshall Genzer would be perfect for this assignment. Her twin boys are 20 months old now. So we asked Nancy, how's the planning going? She and her family agreed to bare their financial souls. And this is the story she put together for us a couple of months ago.
When you're pregnant, you get all kinds of unsolicited advice. Let them cry it out. Pick them up before they cry. No pacifiers. Nurse them for 6 months, a year, 2 years. And whatever you do, get your financial life in order and start saving for college. Now. Oops. The boys are toddlers now. My husband Jan and I are decent savers. But we're even better procrastinators. We don't have a solid financial plan. So even though I'm a financial reporter, I jumped at the chance to trek out to a hospital in suburban Maryland to cover its financial planning seminar for expectant parents. Maybe I would learn something. Before things got started, I sat down with Stuart Ritter, the financial planner from T. Rowe Price, who would lead the seminar. He began with a body blow: how much it actually takes to raise a child from birth to age 17.
The total cost, according to the Department of Agriculture, is about $222,000. And not to scare you even further, but that does not include any savings for college.
Oh. Okay, Nancy's going to need some oxygen. Do we have that anywhere?
I recovered in time for the seminar.
Okay, each of you has a piece of paper that says prioritizing exercise.
Ritter told me and about a dozen couples to get our finances together. I was feeling guilty enough about being behind. Then I met Lannon and Duane Talaferro. She's not even pregnant yet, but here they are doing their homework ahead of time, sitting in the front row. I tried not to hate them. After the seminar, Duane told me they're both scientists and planners.
Well, I think as scientists, we're used to planning ahead and doing the research before we actually act. And so that kind of fits into who we are.
Our research falls into the realm of, hey, we're out of diapers. The seminar put me in full panic mode. Stuart Ritter had given us a checklist to take home. A grim list of obligations marches down the page. Retirement, wills, guardians for our kids, life insurance, college savings. A couple nights later, I showed the checklist to Jan, my husband. We were sitting down in the kitchen to have the talk, the one we should have had before the twins were born.
So I went to this seminar, and I got a bunch of information.
That's wonderful. Was it entertaining?
No. It was kind of scary.
I go over the checklist with Jan. First thing, retirement. Ritter says we should be sure we're saving for retirement before socking away college money. Otherwise, we'll end up broke, moving in with our kids. Ritter says it's like what flight attendants tell you. Secure your oxygen mask before helping your child. We are actually saving for retirement. I want to check that off. But Jan reminds me.
We're planning, but we don't have enough in there. We're not going to be able to live on that.
Well, at least we're doing it. At least we're saving.
No,
we're not
trying.
Right, we're trying.
We're
not saving enough, but we're trying. So I'm putting
a
check mark.
Is this what we can ask for a raise?
It's a good idea.
Moving right along. Life insurance is next on the list. We have some. We definitely need a lot more, as in, if you have little kids, about 10 times your salary. And assuming we don't die young and leave our sons a mountain of insurance money to pay for college, we'd better start a college savings plan. I guess. Some parents don't save anything. I kind of like the sound of that. They think the more savings, the less financial aid they'll get. Wrong. Most aid is actually loans. It's like saying you're not going to save for a car because if you do, you won't get as big a loan from the dealer. So the question now is how much to save.
So we have to decide what our priorities are and whether we want to live the good life now or do we want to save for college.
The good life? I'm happy if I have a chair. If I find a chair, it's a vacation. That's the good life.
We decide to go for broke. Literally, pouring every extra cent we have into a college fund. Here's another body blow from Stuart Ritter. 17 years from now, when our twins are heading off to school, the average private university will cost almost $96,000 a year, times two for twins. Now, we have a choice on college savings plans. We can prepay tuition, but that requires a big block of money. We opt for 529 plans, which allow you to save gradually. Sold. We're at the end of the list.
I think we're done. I feel pretty good. Do you feel pretty good?
I'm shitting.
Other than that, do you feel? I think this is good for us. We're gonna do this.
Absolutely. Let's go.
A little more enthusiasm would be nice. And I wish he'd stop talking with his mouth full. But at least we have a plan. If I ever run into those perfect pre-planning scientists again, I can be proud. Our boys couldn't care less. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to the folks at Starbucks. We know you're going with the tradition you've established using Italian words for your drink sizes, but we thought you should know. When you start offering to supersize your iced drink soon to a full 31 ounces, be aware that 31 in Italian does not translate to
30.
Okay, so 30 may sound good, but it's inaccurate. That actually means 30, and the computer robot Italian speaker at Google's translate page frankly sounds really disappointed when she tells us that 31 ounces should actually be
31.
That's right, 31. No wonder the rest of the world thinks we Americans can't do math. Isn't that just great?
Grande.
Oh, yeah, sorry, grande. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today was a holiday for Wall Street. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. You can track how the markets pick up trading tomorrow morning on the Marketplace Morning Report. And next time on this show, a new website that allows consumers to complain could cost companies millions.
A bad review could cost you $10,000 a month. A few bad reviews can put you out of business.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.